week at the end of the day.
All right, I'd like to welcome you to Sunstone Session number 274, a tribute to Arthur Henry King, 1910 to 2000, scholar, poet, mentor, friend. And this session is sponsored by the Arthur Henry King Foundation. We have four panelists today, each of whom will memorialize Arthur's life from a different angle. And then we plan to leave time for you to add your own brief tributes to this exceptional man. Our first panelist will be Fred Pinniger. Fred earned his PhD in American Literature from the University of Arizona in 1990 and has taught at Purdue University, Western Michigan University, BYU, and UVSC. He has published articles and read conference papers on Herman Melville, Lawrence Stern, L. Frank Baum, William Faulkner, the history of medicine, literature, and medicine, and Southwestern history. Forthcoming from BYU Studies is a gathering of Arthur King's poetry called Conversion, and in the near future, the collected verse numbering some 1,500 poems will also be published. In addition to teaching literature and advanced writing courses, Fred has also does commissioned writing, editing, and consulting through a company called Writing Specialists, and he recently started a publishing company which specializes in children's and regional studies. That imprint is known as Sharpspear Press. Fred worked with Arthur over a period of 7 years to gather and edit the collected poetry and prepare notes and commentary on the verse. He is a charter member of the Arthur Henry King Foundation and has served as president of that organization since February of this year. Our second speaker will be Giles Florence, who believes that he shared more chocolate with Arthur Henry King than anyone except his wife, Patricia. Giles received his master's degree in English at BYU under Arthur's direction. After 16 years in publishing, first at The Ensign, where he worked for 8 years, and then with book publishers, Giles is currently the executive director of Waterford Senior Living Community in Salt Lake. He and his wife, Anne, are the parents of 6 children. The oldest, Nathan, painted a beautiful portrait of Arthur that hangs in the BYU library. Our third panelist is Jean England, who has, if you've been following the symposium, has already spoken a number of times. He is currently the writer-in-residence and program coordinator for Mormon Cultural Studies at Utah Valley State College. He's one of the founding editors of Dialogue, a journal for Mormon thought, and was one of 2 editors of Harvest Contemporary Mormon Poems, which includes 5 poems by Arthur. He's a longtime Sunstone supporter as well. I'll be the fourth panelist. I'm Karen Maloney. I also worked with Arthur under his direction for my master's degree in English at BYU. And I later earned a PhD in English, emphasizing modern British and Anglo-Irish literature at UCLA. I'm now an associate professor of English at Weber State University, and I've published articles on contemporary Irish writers, personal essays, and poetry, and I'm currently working on a book about Seamus Heaney. So I'll turn the time over now to our first panelist.
I'm happy to have been invited to this panel discussion concerning Arthur Henry King's work. And unlike many people who know Arthur, I was never one of his honorary students. I tell people I was never quite smart enough to be in that crowd. The first time I met Arthur was at a social gathering for his honors Shakespeare class. Stephanie, my wife, was his research assistant at that time. And after dinner, he asked all to share their talents. And we listened to piano recitals, soliloquies from Hamlet, singing. And when it came to my turn, the only kangaroo among the beauty, as Emily Dickinson says, the only talent I could manage was an artful twitching of my eye. And he was game for it, however. He grabbed a flashlight and closed in for a closer look, and screaming, "Look at it, bag, look at it, bag." He did the Jabberwocky for us that evening, and I know many of you probably have seen him do that as well. You know, Patricia became increasingly upset about his performance of the Jabberwocky, he had to stop because many people thought that for sure this time he had truly gone mad. Also, he became too old to do the leaps that were required during that as well. I discovered that Arthur Henry King, contrary to popular belief, has had a very finely honed sense of humor. And it was a dry wit similar to my own, and over the years we shared a lot of laughs together. I discovered, too, that there were several Arthurs, and not everyone was aware of the multifaceted personality. For example, I found this Swedish newspaper photograph of Arthur with T.S. Eliot, both, as you can see, looking like characters from a Noel Coward play, dressed in black evening attire, their hair slicked back, heads tilted slightly, easily to the left, Arthur's mustache closely razored, Eliot's eyes looking dissipated. The picture was as startling to me as his confession that he had been a Marxist at one time, for a few days, as he said. I replied, "Yes, I've seen the poem." In examining the life work of a person, you get to know a great deal about them, and you come to see their strengths as well as their weaknesses. I accepted the whole man. Horatio says, "I saw him once. He was a goodly king." Hamlet said, "He was a man. Take him for his all." Arthur was a unique spirit who came among us, spent his little time, taught us much, and went away. "I shall not," Hamlet continues, "look upon his like again." Despite his brilliance and achievement, he was always troubled by feelings of professional and social inadequacy, and he roamed the earth searching for the right place, searching for a home, for what he referred to as the right landscape. And he finally found it in this mountain valley. But more importantly, he discovered that the proper landscape was actually more in the faces of his friends who honored and respected him rather than in a specific geographical place. He taught us to appreciate the beauty and variety on the face of the earth by looking at minute particulars. Big things, as he said, frightened him. The big mountains, the big canyons, the big men who wanted everyone to move out of their way. So he observed those small and gentle things which are often overlooked in this big sky country. He could recognize and name the plants and animals, and he understood more than anyone I have ever known our responsibility to both, for there is a place for them in God's eternal economy. He and Patricia were forever taking in strays of both the four-legged and the two-legged variety, which gave and received love. And he wanted to be buried where he is, in the Orem Cemetery across from the old Word Perfect complex, because it is only about 150 yards from the hidden place where the city workers dump the bodies of animals run over and killed by cars and trucks, like one of his own animals, like his own father when he was 9 years old. He taught us to be steadfast while under oppression, to have dignity in defeat. When I asked him directly, he refused to identify, said he didn't know his enemies in the English department at BYU, who still detest and despise him, and who forced him to take shelter in the philosophy department. Even today, 20 years later, it is still a perilous thing there for one concerned about his or her career to be identified as a friend of Arthur. He taught us about our responsibilities and duties as citizens of the city of God. He taught us to see beyond our differences and to love one another. He taught us how to escape from the blinding solipsism of self and to give ourselves, to lose ourselves in service to others. He was sometimes extremely critical of us individually, as students wrapped up so much in ourselves that we could see nothing. He has been critical of American culture as well. My English grandfather, from very nearly the same generation as Arthur, used to say he could hardly wait for some American to go to heaven and come back and complain about it. But he was, after all, called by a prophet of God to be a kind of missionary in reverse and teach us some things we needed to know. I asked him about this after his return from his missionary service as temple president in England, about whether he still had this attitude. And I thought it was refreshing to hear him say that, the problems, that he saw problems in his own culture as well, and he admitted these things frankly. He taught us to remember our dreams because, while we may not understand them at first, they tell us worlds about ourselves. Many, a very high percentage of all of the poems he wrote are what I refer to as dream visions. They're a straightforward recording of his dreams, his dream life, his dream works, as Freud says. And I said, you know, Arthur, what's this mean? And he says simply, I don't know. I don't have a clue. You know, this is the dream as it occurred. He taught us how to make language the foundation of our study and be aware of how much our language betrays us and reveals our most authentic character. As I tell my students, if you want to understand your scriptures better, study Shakespeare. If you want to better understand Shakespeare, study your scriptures. They are both in the same language. He taught us how to face death, our own as well as that of those close to us. Heaven knows he was an expert in this. Having witnessed it at close hand in his father, his son, his wife, his stepdaughter, father-in-law, and myriad other friends and family members, and having contemplated this great human event and written on it at length as a major thematic concern in his poetry. We have a duty to the dying. And it was a curious thing to see who would come, who would still come, and visit with Arthur as he lay dying, wandering in his mind and babbling of green fields, like Falstaff at the end, his body increasingly played backstabbing traitor to him until ultimately it was an unresponsive hulk. But the mind was free. Now there are many more things that he taught us collectively and individually, but these are a few that stand out in my mind today. It is very important that we keep record of our interactions with our mentors. After all, we know many of the great minds and spirits of history only through the records preserved by others. We know Plato mostly through the class notes of his students. We know the Savior of the New Testament largely through the work of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, who were prompted years after the fact to write down the things they saw and heard and preserve the memories of his ministry on the earth. I love Arthur, and I miss him, but it is up to us to remember him and his creative work. A few days before Arthur died, I had a curious dream in which I was speaking at Arthur's funeral, much as I actually did last January. Arthur was in an open casket, and as I spoke, Arthur suddenly sat upright and announced, "I'm not dead yet," like a character in Monty Python, but infinitely more poignant. I have thought since how true and appropriate that vision was, for Arthur is not dead for many people, but rather he lives on. I want to say a few words now about the Arthur Henry King Foundation for Language Study, of which I am president. The organization was founded a few years ago to preserve and promote Arthur's work and spirit. A childless man himself, his infant son died after about a week. Arthur claimed by adoption many sons and daughters whom he referred to as honorary children. There are perhaps 100 or more of these individuals, and they form the core of the organization. There are also many others who were Arthur's students, friends, and neighbors who loved him and cared about him. As I said to the nurse there at the nursing home, take good care of this man. There are many people who love him. We meet in a small group for informal discussions each month, and there is also an annual birthday party in February. If you would like me to put your name on the mailing list, please write me a brief note and give it to me after the meeting. There are many projects which the foundation would like to see done. Arthur always saw himself first as a teacher, and he had a profound influence on the personal and professional lives of thousands of people. I think his greatest legacy is the work of these people who have made his methods and his spirit central to their own theoretical perspective. Because of his emphasis on teaching, his actual publication record is somewhat limited. A collection of essays called Abundance of the Heart was published 1980, is that right? About 1980, and recently republished by BYU Studies under a new title, Arm the Children, with additional essays. This is available from BYU Studies.
And it's here.
And it is here. Beyond that, a small handful of poems and essays have been published in various venues, including Dialogue and also Gene bought a few in his book. However, as I told someone recently, there are perhaps two or three more books of essays and speeches which could be published. My own book of selected poems focused on his conversion experience. This is penned from BYU Studies Press, as well as the collected verse, some 1,500 poems at a later date. I believe that either an edition of Shakespeare could be issued annotated with Arthur's notes, or at least a Shakespearean commentary based on his work could be published. This could be done very easily on a CD, given the available technology. And I would also like to see a comprehensive biography produced and published by those who were closest to him. I appreciate your coming today, and I'm looking forward to hearing your comments, your questions concerning the life of this wonderful man. Thank you.
In 1970, I discovered a compelling reason to stay at BYU and work on my master's degree there. It was I had returned from a mission to England and had discovered my Anglophilia. I loved everything English, and anything that walked with an English accent attracted me. And so I was drawn to this classroom for a summer visiting professor named Arthur King, and I immediately found him appealing, but for all the wrong reasons. He was erudite and charming and witty and brilliant, and many of those things disarmed me as a BYU student. I had been taught by a lot of fairly sober, fairly serious people who taught me a reverence for language and for the canon of Western literature. And Arthur disrupted that considerably. And for that reason, I was attracted to him. And I discovered in my new advocacy or my new following of this man a love of, an intense and passionate love of Christ, of chocolate, of dogs, and words. And in that, the ensuing relationship, I began to realize that all of these had a certain kind of both sobriety and sanctity, as well as a kind of delight. And I've tried to learn how to treat animals the way Arthur treats them. He has a vision of the celestial spirit of beasts, and there's just something that hasn't quite been passed on to me, as my children will attest. Our dogs continue to annoy me. Of course, we have one that's deaf, completely deaf, and it obeys nothing that I tell it to do. But while working on a teaching fellowship that I received under Ed Hart while getting my master's degree, I had the privilege of teaching Pulitzer Prize poets. And that was a sort of presumptuous thing for a master's degree student to do. But under Dr. Hart's tutelage and direction, it became a wonderful experience. But while I was doing that, I would go from my teaching of that class to Arthur's Shakespeare class and discovered something about the power of his teaching. I think the first thing that struck me was that I'd always made notes in the margins of interesting things professors said while I was filling the rest of my page with notes. In Arthur's class, I filled the page with his asides and the little margin with the notes of the class. Well, you can see I'm not much of a scholar, but I was attracted to his insights beyond what the text had to say, even though for Arthur, it was the text that was the thing. Well, it took a long time for me to discover that that's what it was all about. And we would meet with him and Patricia and other students in these frequent soirees at their home. And not only would we drench ourselves in the insights and the enjoyment of the occasion, but in chocolate. And I think I had never known another adult who delighted in eating candy quite so much. And I thought, this is my kind of person. I thought, here he presents himself with this sort of formal British dignity, you know, with the language, the bearing, and all of that reserve. And yet, as he unzips, out comes this child ready to play with you with any kind of wordplay and munch a big bar of chocolate. And Patricia and he would not just have bars of chocolates. They would have these massive Giardelli blocks of chocolates that would come in, I think, either inch or 2 inch thick slabs, and they would break these things off and give you a piece. It's like sitting in the mead hall, you know, just chomping down and waiting for someone to pass around the mead and the next layer of straw to clean up the mess. Well, I saw this as a healthy addiction, frankly, and allowed myself to indulge in it. But what I wasn't aware of was that behind his indulgence was a lifetime of discipline. And I had been, as I have begun to write in a novel, I had been born an American. And I was, as I'm working to say better, a natural-born liar. My father and mother were both embellishers. They were caught up in the excesses of their time, swept along in the rising tide of expectation and possibility, blown by an alluring breeze of prosperity and plenty that surrounded them. It was a time when most Americans had begun to believe the same lie. They lived it and told it to their children, and in different words, they still do. Arthur taught me that not only was I a liar by nature, but that we as people were. In fact, he quoted Isaiah's, "I am a man of unclean lips," and told me about not only Isaiah and himself and myself in our inability to be truly true to the person we were trying to become, but taught me that all things superlative, which is what America has been built on, right? Everything is the most, the new, the best, that those things were to be distrusted. And so I began to go into this sort of deep spiral of self-analysis and discover that there is hardly anything right about me. And I sincerely looked back and thought at Arthur's funeral, why did I ever meet Arthur? What good did he do me? He sent me in such a... he taught us to lose ourselves in devotion to whatever the thing is, whether it's serving Christ or studying our literature or living our life, and to be unselfconscious. But in fact, all it did for me was make me feel more self-analytical. And I thought there was something wrong with this. Well, there was. At any rate, he said of superlatives, in fact, he said that particularly those superlatives that cause comparisons, he said, most distinguished persons are scoundrels because they have some kind of label of importance. He agreed with Ben Jonson that the virtue resides in the minute particulars, as Fred said. And as I tried to understand what that meant to me, that the particulars, the details, the text, the word, what was that all about? If I was a natural-born liar and the word was a manipulation for me, a tool, a means of getting what I wanted, and of trying to impress other people, then there were some things I needed to learn. And so Arthur adopted me, called me a son, and I called him Pater. And I went through a rather difficult rebirth process, not only the taking of classes and meeting in these groups and traveling with him and Patricia up to the Uintas. We would do a kind of annual retreat every fall. We would go up to, at first it was a place along the river and ultimately became a spot near Mirror Lake, where we would go and have a picnic and drink in the beauties of nature and talk about, at the time, some of my favorite poets, Hopkins and others, who had done a beautiful job of writing about nature. He liked my master's thesis, The Dialectic Against the Quotidian, which had to do with Wallace Stevens's intentional study of writing and deliberate writing as a means of keeping the sensibility alive in a world that tried to drown our sensibilities. And in those outings to the Uintas, we would do, some of the silliness would come out again. And we populated an entire city, I think, or a barnyard, with some bulls. Adorable was the heroine. Edible was the boy hero. And his father was the constable, and he was preparing to marry them, and they would live heavily after. Except that there were these brutes in the neighborhood who tried to interfere with the relationship, terrible and horrible, and anyway, we went on and on and spent hours laughing about these bulls that were somehow the antithesis of a serious Shakespeare scholar sitting in the woods in the mountains. And as I began to realize that what I had grown up as a person who saw the importance of posturing and using language to get ahead and try to discover ways to get gain, as Hugh Nibley often points out to us, I realized that it was only in getting lost in the things that Arthur showed us and that he believed that Christ was here to share with us that that I would ever make my way out of it. So I began to write some poetry based on the things that Arthur taught me, and I'd like to share two of those with you and then close with a thought. We were sitting around in an afternoon in their house, and Patricia was the adopter of cats. T.S. Eliot would have loved her. She had names for them. They were all different kinds of cats. And if there was a stray cat in the neighborhood, it would usually end up at Patricia's house. And she tolerated all Arthur's love of dogs. He tolerated her love of cats, and the house was full of these animals. And she also loved to preserve, put up fruit and jams. And so this is a poem about two children that these two adults were. The schoolboy, this is called August Afternoon, the schoolboy you have never stopped being is the descant to Patricia's paradox. Enter the cats, who all without any apparent effort be welcome, as are we all. They, who in both posture and grace attend her, as if to ask, what mistress is this who so hearty with rolled sleeves and hands preserved today in cherries, sets aside all and supple arms akimbo, steps a robust hornpipe that rouses cats from sleep and you from your profound particulars. And after this, she sets the table. There was something wonderfully practical about Patricia and her tolerance of Arthur's pontifications. I mean, he would sit around and I don't know how he would drop in a literary allusion between every single word that he spoke, but it seemed to come out that way. And because he was so well read and because most of those allusions went over most of our heads, we did our best to simply bounce back and forth between helping Patricia with the food and him with, you know, and trying to understand what he was on about. I read this at his funeral, and it's a poem that tells me, reminds me, one of the things, one of the most central influences he was in my life. Our family has a cabin up by Wildwood, and so that's the name, Wildwood, when you hear that. It's up near Sundance. It was you that told me there is no good. In your oboe soft and solitary voice, you said one evening, ambered by a September hearth, blazing at Wildwood, your eyebrows throwing fierce shadows on your forehead and a portent of the truth into my heart. There is no good, you sighed, staring into the flames. Only good men. Nothing more. Reflecting on your face in that firelight, an ember yet glows within my breast where it burns beside the question it may be too soon to ask. Yes, and why so few? Arthur he didn't like calling, having anyone credit him with anything. I suppose he'd probably be displeased with us today, spending time talking about him or adulating him. And I wrote an article for This People back in 1984 in which I tried to introduce people who couldn't ever be expected to understand this paradoxical and I think contradictory kind of man. I tried to explain what he was like. And all I found out was from our academic friends was that they thought that I was too adulatory of Arthur in the article. So it turns out that you can't please anybody when you're trying to please them. You just try to do what you know is right. Well, in conclusion, I guess I would like to say that Arthur did throw me into a deep tailspin about what I was trying to do with my life. But it was only after discovering that the long hours of preparation, the long discipline of one's life through study of the scriptures, through study of literature, can one lose oneself in the very thing he was talking about. And I'll close with this quote from him from The Abundance of the Heart. I shared Fred's ardor for this, for Arthur's insight about the power of death. And at his funeral, it became clear to me again that Arthur bore testimony of death as a power, as a great power in our lives. He says, as I've tried to show you, the experience of death is perhaps the greatest experience of love that we shall have in this world. And, of course, he goes on to say that it's because of the separation that death brings us and its ever presence in our lives that makes us value the moment that we're living in. And he seemed to be, of all people I've ever known, capable of doing that, whether he was studying, and he would do that. I remember one time visiting with him as a student was coming to do a study, individual study with him, and Arthur was preparing for that presentation. He had been in this career for decades and decades, and a student was coming to talk about a poem that Arthur was not prepared to discuss with that person without preparation and a review. What a remarkable statement that was to me. Pretty good at shooting from the hip and being glib, and preparation was not that familiar. And I appreciated the model, the example that he was, and grateful for his reminder that the power of death is the thing that intensifies each moment of our lives, and should. And I'm grateful for the knowledge of Arthur in my life. Thanks.
I first met Arthur Henry King in 1969. My friend Robert Reese, who is teaching at UCLA in the English department, called me. We were at Stanford in Palo Alto and asked if we could host a man he had met through a colleague in the English department. Arthur was a very distinguished educator, head of the British Institute, traveling throughout the world through Commonwealth nations, involved with teaching English as a second language and overseeing educational processes there, and also as a guest lecturer at other places. And he was on his way to Stanford, and I was asked to host him. He was not a member of the church, but Robert pointed out some of the remarkable things he had learned about him in just a brief acquaintance, and we met him with some trepidation. We had six young children, and here was a very distinguished English person with this rather formidable look that you see in this picture right here, and the accent and so forth. And it was a remarkable experience to see him respond to our children and to us as we spent that evening together. One of the things that happened, that has happened with no other person I've known, is that we, Charlotte and I both, established a relationship with him, a heart-to-heart relationship that didn't need a constant refreshment in order to persist. We didn't really spend a lot of time with him in his life, but whenever we did see him in any situation, it was as if we had just continued the earlier conversation with the same feeling and the same depth. It was a remarkable thing, and his quality that made that possible. Our closeness, our love, and our friendship was renewed immediately on walking into his presence. He joined the church and came to BYU in the early 70s, and then had the remarkable career that you know about, and that has influenced many of you. He didn't find a home in the English department. I understand that. I've had some troubles finding a home in the English department there, too. But in 1974, he had been invited by Terry Warner, head of the honors program, to be involved in what he was doing. And Terry was very interested in bringing me there from St. Olaf College, where I was dean of academic affairs. And Charlotte and I went out to look at a place to live and to talk more about that. And we went to Terry's office and had a meeting with Arthur and Terry. And Terry asked Arthur to open with prayer. And it was truly a remarkable prayer, a kind of one of these experiences that open you out. I remember specifically him, this was a kind of typical Utah, actually not that typical when you think of it, May day with scudding clouds coming across, and even little patches of snow falling and then rain, a kind of late, harsh spring day, right after apparently a week of hot weather. And Arthur prayed that the Lord would let this changing weather enable us to change our minds. Wonderful way he had of using the natural world as a symbol of spiritual reality. I'd like to celebrate his poetry in my little contribution to this program. In 1988, I published a collection with Dennis Clark of Mormon poems, contemporary Mormon poems, and we selected five of Arthur's from this immense work that he has done and that Fred is getting published in various ways. I wish him well. I think they well deserve it. But we chose a few to give a sense of his range and also what I saw as most important about his work. And I'd like to just suggest two qualities. One was this remarkable attention to the text and seeing the world as text, to see it with precision, both at the surface and in its ability to reveal in an almost transcendental, well, a transcendental way, other truths. This is a haiku that he wrote called Timpanogos. Across the silver network of birch and poplar, a shiver of gold. The Florences and we both have cabins in the shadow of places to live in the shadow of Timpanogos. I think we can testify that that gets it and gets many other things about our world. Across the silver network of birch and poplar, a shiver of gold. The other quality is one that's implicit in this poem. That word shiver has, of course, a rich and complex meaning. And the thing that impresses me most about this man and his poetry especially is that he had in him never quite resolved the contraries that Giles has talked specifically about. This demeanor, the child as well, the ability to disrupt as well as to delight our lives, as he did Giles's. He had in him, I think, a deep sense of the great conflicts that religion inevitably creates in our lives. A line that always rings in my heart when I think of Arthur is the line, "It is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the God of Israel." I know that's true. The God of Israel asks you to bet your life on him, and he exacts great costs as well as giving great rewards. And he gives us a world, and I think Mormon theology especially gives us a world that is not simple, that is full of contraries. And Arthur brought to his Mormon conversion some sense of that, and it deepened as he understood Mormon theology. Jeffrey Pingree spoke of this the other night and suggesting in a very respectful way that Richard Dutcher's film about missionaries could be, or he could do deeper work if he could capture a sense of the deep conflicts within the religious person as well as between elements of our culture, which he has done so well in that film. Let me just read a poem that immediately gets us into that world. The references, I think, probably have to do with driving with Giles up to Mirror Lake through Provo Canyon by the Deer Creek Reservoir with its great chasms coming down through the mountain into the lake, dark shadows. These are all present in this poem. He cites as the title and as a kind of epigraph the passage from Jeremiah chapter 20, verse 4. "I will make thee a terror to thyself. I have made endeavor to serve thee, Lord, and yet thy servant, this thy child, is apprehensive at thy majesty. Under the blue of day I bow to glory, acknowledging in gratitude here goodness, there beauty, and sometimes the two glancing together. But as I drive at night between high mountains, their summits lost in looming cloud, or along the edge of some black avist lake, whose unknown depth I hope not accidentally to plumb. I hope that's not a reference to your driving, John. Whose unknown depth I hope not accidentally to plumb, or watch an improbable sea smash up at an impossible cliff, or even round the zoo, observing the tiger yawn, the elephant put his foot down, the octopus tentative, the spider leap, the 15-foot hamadryad caught on the Singapore golf course by coolies who thought him a python, lunge at the reinforced glass. Or as I await at the clinic on someone close to me, a specialist's careful conclusion, I feel the general terror. Love beyond, above, and beneath us may appall us because it exceeds our measure. Love that creates and includes the predator should startle us into reconsideration. And make what thou wilt to exercise thine own free agency. Help me to sense neither sheer terror nor mere beauty, but both one grace and strength, winging the bird of awe to soar in the courts of thy sublimity. Aid me to relegate ignoble fear to the land of that so-called prince of darkness, for thou art the king of thy deep night as of thy light, O Christ. Clifton Jolly, in a wonderful essay, picked up on this image and talked about Christ and our commit to him, bringing us face to face with the beast in ourselves, which is Christ, the ultimate demand he makes on us. That pseudo-Lucifer who aspired above the aristocracy and fell to acting the gentleman. What a wonderful capturing of Satan, and use, of course, the pun, the pseudo-light-bearer who aspired above the aristocracy and fell to acting the gentleman. In the last analysis, fright turns out to be a kind of giddiness at the precipices of our own inadequacy, appears to stalk through and spring from our own inner landscape. It is not what thou hast made, but what we make of ourselves as an interim measure, for terror can fill any interval before the apparent ultimate, and yet that medial time, in quotes, can be redeemed from acrophobia. An interim measure, a ring of faltering steps to widen horizons, reveal peaks further and higher, open gulfs deeper for thy love to fill. Briefly, to free us from that cozy world where each Saturday night Father winds the grandfather clock, then switches off the light, to release the reign of terror, the rule of uncomprehended love. Enable us, therefore, to realize that we shall continue to render Pan some breath of involuntary worship until we come nearer to understanding and, yes, matching thy love. I think when I read these poems of Joseph Smith in the Grove, we talk about the first vision in very comforting and comfortable terms. I cannot think of a greater terror than Joseph Smith faced, as he had the courage as a 14-year-old to ask the ultimate question and face the ultimate decision, because the answer to his question could mean heaven or hell. And his account of the devil's attack on him is, I think, a perfect symbol of what was at stake. And his earlier accounts give us, in some ways, that more terribly when he faced that beast than the version that he wrote later in life, when he had reconciled many of these contraries, though not all. And I think he went to his death with some of them left. Arthur did too, but he worked at it. Let me read two more. This relates to Giles' reading about his view of death. This is a wonderful contrary, of course, not reconciled in this poem, but maybe in the next one I'll read. Death is the frame of love. Our skeleton's the groundwork of our play. And however we move, the bones move in us that outlast the clay. Yet bone is a firm ground to build the highest act of love upon. If love by death is bound, it is by limbs in virtue of their bone. In skull, blade, groin, hip, knee, we grasp the form that will outlast the eye. Without these dead things, we should not be we to know each other by. Let me read that again. Without these dead things, we should not be we to know each other by. Bone as the frame of love outlasts the picture. What joy can be there? Dust the loved self must prove, but bone framed joy from love's mere flesh and air. And finally, Hebrews 11, strangers and pilgrims. Had we a home elsewhere and chose one here? From home the stranger makes his crying start. A touch, a taste, a scent, a voice of dear concern, a look from eyes to beating heart, a window on the world. The pilgrim sees a tree beside a gate, then many trees. We take an avenue to find our own, look for a city. Is our town the place? We love our country, seek another one. We gain a wife or husband by thy grace, a home and children, ours. Away, they've gone to find their own. Still seeking, we press on. The valley of the shadow, Lord, thy hand. We spirit pilgrims long in paradise, yet still unloving earth, for home, a land of promise and fulfillment. May we rise, our flesh and bone exalted from the dust in that first resurrection of the just. No longer strange, but pilgrims of that age, our reunited families can sing, not solitary on our pilgrimage, but companied at work for thee, our King, 1,000 years, till through refining flame, one home, all crystal, radiates thy name.
In The Group, an essay which the Irish poet Seamus Heaney wrote for the Belfast Review, The Honest Ulsterman, in 1978, he describes Philip Hobsbawm, a lecturer at Queen's University, who enthusiastically mentored a group of aspiring Belfast poets in the mid-60s. Hobsbawm's character, as depicted by Heaney, has always struck me as similar to that of my own poetry mentor, Arthur Henry King. Heaney recalls Hobsbawm, for example, as a man who, like Arthur, quote, emanated energy, generosity, belief in the community, trust in the parochial, the inept, the unprinted. He was impatient, dogmatic, relentlessly literary, yet he was patient with those he trusted, unpredictably susceptible to a wide variety of poems and personalities. If he drove some people mad with his absolutes and hurt others with his overbearing, he confirmed as many with his enthusiasms. He and his wife, Hannah, kept open house for poetry, and I remember his hospitality and encouragement with the special gratitude we reserve for those who have led us toward confidence in ourselves, end quote. Heaney's tribute to Hobsbawm is clearly particularized, but for me it is also an apt portrait of Arthur, relentlessly literary and often dogmatic, who confirmed me with his enthusiasm and led me towards a new kind of confidence. When I decided during my final semester in 1974 as a graduate student in library science to return to the writing of verse I had enjoyed as a child and teenager, I was not terribly clear how to proceed. One faithful friend, Rick Huckel, who couldn't be here today, persuaded me to take my poems to Arthur for evaluation. Arthur's imposing presence on campus, however, had intimidated me. I had attended one honors program banquet where there was rock music being played, and he had stood up at the back of the room and denounced it and left in a huge huff. And so I was intimidated. So Rick agreed to take the poems to Arthur in my place. On the morning of that meeting, however, I decided I must be there too and promptly proceeded to get lost finding Arthur's office. So Rick met alone with Arthur after all, and then later relayed to me Arthur's comments as he read my poems. Essentially, this can't be done. This can't be done. This can't be done. But adding as a final note, she has talent and I would like to meet her. And so I scheduled the next appointment on my own. At that meeting, he asked me to read I.A. Richards' book, Practical Criticism, before coming back. Standard procedure I would learn when embarking on a new tutorial relationship with a would-be poet. I met with Arthur to work on my verse, say, 6 times over that semester, an hour to 2 on each occasion. My journal records how, quote, he helped me clear up archaicisms, recognized the good lines, gave me an understated praise when deserved that made me incredibly happy, end quote. When I finished my degree in December and left for Australia soon after to work as a high school librarian, we kept in touch by letter, sometimes even discussing his poems. Then when I returned to BYU to pursue a master's in English, he became the advisor for my creative writing thesis. Working for the next 3 years on that project with Arthur was one of the most joyful things I've ever done. When I brought a poem to Arthur, he always regarded it with immense respect, as he might a cherished friend whose flaws did not cancel his or her virtues. And when we discussed that poem, though we might be playing with its rhythm or evaluating a metaphor, we were also probing our memories and evaluating the quality of our lives. We were also engaging in an exchange of warmth and love and understanding that sustains me still as I think of it now. Only recently I completed a challenging writing project on an Irish play, and one of my first impulses was the desire to show it to Arthur, whose eyes I know would have glowed with pride, even if I were writing of a contemporary and therefore questionable playwright. I was only one of many students whose poetry writing Arthur encouraged, only one of a number of creative thesis advisees. What Arthur should always be remembered for was his ability to work with many students and to approach each as an individual, never imposing his own style on a student, which I find remarkable among creative writers, and allowing the student to develop freely. Brewster Giesellen, in his book, The Creative Process, speaks of ideas and tells us that we, quote, must learn to seize and hold them without insistence, letting them agitate the mind when and as they may and make their own development, relinquishing them as they fade or fail of effect, and taking of others to be cherished without attachment in the same way, end quote. That is how Arthur treated his students, cherishing them without attachment, working to facilitate each student's unique development. As a teacher of literature now myself, and at least once a year of a creative writing course, I only occasionally live up to the standard Arthur set for me, though I do endeavor to create a nurturing environment for my fledgling poets and short story writers. And when I meet with them individually, I attempt to treat their efforts with the kind of respect Arthur showed to me. And when I teach introduction to poetry courses, I invariably begin with an assignment adapted from Richard's practical criticism, asking my students to pretend that they're freshmen at Cambridge University during the 1920s. But from the other side of the counter, so to speak, I appreciate even more the careful wording of Arthur's individualized comments on my work, and especially the value of the time he gave me. Arthur Henry King went far beyond the proverbial extra mile for me as my tutor, advisor, and advocate. Not surprisingly, then, I came to think of Arthur, as did so many others, as a father figure. He encouraged me to go to Australia when most of my friends thought I was crazy. He comforted me when my own much-loved father died later that year. We talked of his adventures in other countries. We talked of my adventures in other countries. Usually this would take the format of talking about the poems, actually. We talked of our mutual love for genealogy. He followed the ups and downs of my career plans and romances. He advised me to study the entries on American and English literature in the Encyclopedia Britannica when preparing for my GREs, which was a very good tip, by the way. After I graduated and left for California, we visited during my vacation trips to Utah. One summer, Patricia and he let me live with them for several weeks as I attempted to focus again on my poetry. The length of time between visits increased as I entered my own PhD program, and though our at least yearly correspondence, with Patricia's help, endured, we visited in person only twice after I returned to Utah to teach at Weber State. But when I saw him at his retirement party in Orem several years ago, suffering as he was from Parkinson's, his eyes still shone to see me again. And the tears came quickly to my own as the years dissolved between us. At Arthur's funeral, I learned that his patriarchal blessing had foretold that this childless man would yet have children. And I understood a bit better why he had gone so far out of his way for me, why he had been willing to open his heart to me. It had been no accident that I had come to look upon Arthur as a father. Recently, I was allowed to choose a keepsake or two of Arthur's to look after until a fitting memorial room somewhere might be arranged to house them. I chose a framed certificate naming him a fellow with the British Council in 1966, and I chose Arthur's British passport. If I had been forced to choose between the two tokens, there would have been no contest. My one memento would have been his passport. Arthur and I shared a love for travel, yes, but even more importantly, his mentoring gave me a passport to the world outside myself. This Quaker Mormon, as I have come to think of him, who strove for simplicity of lifestyle and honesty of expression, was not without his detractors or his flaws. But his occasional impatience, eccentricity, or lack of charity never canceled his virtues. My journal records my decision 26 years ago to take my poems to Arthur Henry King as a turning point in my life, and that is indeed how I felt about it then. Today, with hindsight, and hopefully some of the maturity that Arthur hoped I would gain, that's one of the reasons he thought I should go to Australia, my feelings have not changed about his influence on my life. I think of Arthur's kindnesses towards me as Heaney remembered Hobsbawm's hospitality and encouragement, with the special gratitude we reserve for those who have led us toward confidence in ourselves. Right. I know there are at least a few of you who would like to or should make a few remarks now, and I'd like to turn the time over to you and maybe keep your comments to several minutes in length so that other people can talk too. Do you want to start, Bob?
My name is Robert Reese. I had the privilege of being one of the first people in the church to meet Arthur Henry King. A colleague of mine at UCLA by the name of Don Bowen had worked with Arthur in international education. And when he came to Los Angeles to visit Don made sure that Arthur and I met one another. There was an immediate kind of kinship there. I can't really explain except to say that it was something that as if we had known each other for a long time. I was delighted to find that he was a poet, and more delighted to find that he was a very good poet, and ask him for some of his poems that we published in Dialogue. I remember a couple of very specific things about Arthur. One, I picked him up once at the airport and brought him to UCLA during the time of the riots in Watts. And I was telling him how despairing it was to have this kind of destruction happening to our city. And I was basically talking about the world coming to an end or something like this. And Arthur said, Robert, you must always believe that you can make a difference. And that was very important to me, the kind of optimism that that he exemplified. I can remember having a dinner with him at the London Temple. I went down when he was the temple president and went through a session with him, and he took me out to a proper English dinner, which he loved to eat, and he and I both thoroughly enjoyed that. I remember, I called Robert Thomas and to tell him about the experience, and I said that I'd met this remarkable man, and I said, I think he's the most distinguished convert the church has had in a long time. And that that sense of distinguishment, that kind of bearing that Arthur had, his love of language, his love of people, like all of us, he had his prejudices. He and I certainly were not in agreement about things modern, but I was terribly impressed that he knew T.S. Eliot, because I was teaching T.S. Eliot, and he could tell me a lot about T.S. Eliot, and I thought anyone who was a friend or an acquaintance of T.S. Eliot must have had some considerable stature in the world. Well, in my own life, he had indeed considerable stature, and I considered it an honor to count him as a friend, and have been very pleased to hear the tributes made to him today. Thank you.
My name is Edrin Helvey. I have a question of the panel. It stems from a counter that is very vague in my mind now. I don't know with whom I was speaking, nor even where I was. But someone indicated that Brother Ken's unusual conversion experience, and this person's assessment of it, was that when the Lord needs someone to do something, he goes out and he gets them. And that was why Arthur Henry King was converted, that the Lord needed him to do something. And I've forgotten now even what it was that he wanted him to do, although at the time I'm sure the person told me what he felt that was. And so my question to the panel is, do you know what his conversion story was? I would be interested because of that to... It is in there. Oh, well, I'll be interested to read that then.
The question was, what year was he president of the London Temple? And the answer is?
87, 88, 89, somewhere in there.
The late 80s, maybe 87 to 89.
Excuse me, while she's coming up, some of you may recall that part of that mission that I think you were referring to, Sister Kelvey, is it? Mrs. Kelvey? Was that Harold B. Lee asked Arthur to come to BYU as a missionary in reverse, which was a kind of calling that was pretty unusual. Most people at BYU thought we were taking the truth out to the rest of the diaspora or whatever, and that Arthur was invited there to bring a truth or a testimony of the richness of culture and language to people who thought we had sort of all the truth. I think it was sort of the impression a lot of people got. I'm sure that's not what President Lee meant by it, but it's sort of my interpretation of the idea of Arthur being a missionary to bring things back to us rather than us always taking things out. Might be part of that.
My name is Catherine Allred. My original name is Taylor, and my father, Stephen O. Taylor, was, like all of you, sort of an adopted son of Arthur Henry, and so if you are his adopted children, then he's my adopted grandfather. And my father encouraged my siblings and I from a young age to talk to Arthur about many things, and in his last weeks that he was in the hospital so much, my younger sister and I went and read poems to him. I haven't cried about this at all, his death or anything, because I was so stunned to hear about it, even though for all my life he was so old, it seemed like he was always on his deathbed or something, and so it was such a shock, and I didn't cry until now, and it's been kind of incredible to come in here. And as a child, it didn't occur to me that he had such an amazing outreach and affected so many people's lives. He was just this guy I knew, and that was a friend of my family's, and it's been really amazing to grow up and see all the people and meet them and hear their incredible stories, and I just wanted to talk about that. I always went to speak with him about poetry with so much trepidation because he was so direct, I guess you could say, to put it nicely, and really charged you to back up any statements that you're going to make with substance, and he really had a lot to do with... I think I had a similar experience as you did. I was used to shooting from the hip. I'm really glib, and he made me take a look at that and things I said. Thank you for being on the panel.
Maybe a question and a comment. I'm not sure if the Arthur Henry King Foundation knows that one tribute that was paid to him probably 20 years ago was the opportunity to be burned in effigy. We had a group of students who realized that no man is truly great until he's been burned in effigy. So we went over to an open area near the temple. Ken Beasley made a fantastic effigy. And we invited Arthur Henry King to come and share a few remarks with us. And he only consented to this bit of adulation because it symbolized the burning of his old body and allowed him to think of his new life ahead of him. But I thought it would be important to know that he had, in the true English tradition, achieved a mark of distinction. One other story which I will share is we had a family friend who... I'm David Sandberg. Sorry. I was at BYU in the late 70s. We had a family friend who in the 80s came to BYU and was working through some speed reading principles that they were trying to use some as possibly educating at the university. King was devastatingly critical of this lady who was could not understand how she comes to the university and is told that she's a tool of Satan. And a friend, a mutual friend, took her aside and said, "You have to understand that if Arthur Henry King read as fast as you are pushing him to, as much as you claim he could read, his brain would explode because he brings so much context to every single word. He just could not do it."
That's great. Excellent.
Since we're sharing, I'm going to share one more thing. I don't know, again, when it was, but Arthur Henry King came to San Francisco. I don't know why he was there, perhaps associated with Berkeley, but anyway, the word went out, and several of us left Berkeley and went over across the bay to hear him speak. I don't remember much about the talk except for one thing, and that was that he held that doing leads to being. And that had not been my experience in the church so far. I don't know whether I still would hold to that, but that was his conviction. If we did something long enough, we could become and be transformed in that doing. And I thought, well, if that's true, that can hold out hope for those of us that sense that we are far, far from being anything that we should be, but that we can at least discipline ourselves to do in the hope that he's right, and through that doing, we may become.
And actually, that's how Fred met Arthur, is because we were married, I think, wasn't it? Anyway, the thing that I've thought a lot about in the last few days, in the days since January when Arthur died, is about my last visits to him. And the two things I remember are that we went to see him just the day, I think, before he died. And he was reading, I guess it was about a week before he died, and he was reading Thomas Mann in the German, and there were little notes all over that he had been writing. You know, his handwriting was pretty illegible at the end, but I thought that I hoped that when I died that I'd still be able to read Thomas Mann, not in the German, because I can't read German, but that was a real inspiration to me. And the second thing that happened was at that same on that same occasion, he's written poetry to a lot of his honoraries and to his wife and to a lot of people who are important to him. And Fred used to tease him that even though they had spent the 7 years together, that he had never written a poem about him. And so on that occasion, he tried to dictate a poem to me about Fred. And anyway, that was a pretty funny day. The thing that Arthur taught me more than anything else is the long discipline of life. When I went to work for him, I was in the middle of writing my honors thesis. My master's thesis. And I walked in on the first day and started working for him, and went home and folded up my master's thesis. And I used to go and sit with him every morning from 8 until noon, and then I'd come home at noon and I would get out my OED and my Shakespeare and then study till about 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and then the next day I'd go back. And the discipline that he taught me from doing that and from attending to the Word, my own PhD's in ed psych, and my area of work is in qualitative research, narrative research, and I'm a narrative phenomenologist, and what I learned was from Arthur to be a narrative phenomenologist, to find out what text that people spoke said. And but my favorite experience with him probably was about when we were in Tucson, and he would come down and spend the winters there when we were graduate students together. One night about 11 o'clock, he called me on the phone and said, come quick, the flower's blooming. And they had some kind of night blooming amaryllis or something. And I went over and sat on the floor, sat in front of his trailer with he and Patricia, and we just sat and watched that flower bloom. And then I went home about 5 o'clock in the morning and just chatted and watched the blooming amaryllis. But those contradictions between his awareness of everything in life and his commitment to scholarship have been really important in the pattern I've made in my own life as an academic and a scholar.
Maxine Hanks is speaking at another panel right now, but she gave me something to read, and I'm not reading the entire thing. It's really a quite nice memorial essay, but I'll just read a portion of it now for Maxine. She writes, "When I was hired to work with Arthur King in spring 1983, I had just been fired from the MTC for heresy and barely finished 2 years' work on the banned Seventh East Press, which I'd been scathed by controversy, conflict, misogyny, and self-doubt. It was a crucible I will never return to, where everything from faith in God to belief in myself unraveled within months. When I took the job of editorial assistant at BYU, I dragged up the steps to Arthur's office, feeling battered and broken, needing a place to heal. Working with Arthur for 3 years was a divine respite from negative appraisals. With Arthur, I could focus on the positive purposes of writing, experience the bliss and inspiration of rhetoric, and hone my own literary skills into gifts. He not only mentored me, he helped me see the larger pattern of my own destiny. My time with Arthur made me whole and left me knowing I had a vital role to play in culture. Referring to me as a far too optimistic and a very handsome woman and the unremitting one, I always found his assessments astute. His compliments were genuine, his advice always tender. My dear, you mustn't overtax yourself. Be sure to get your rest. My dear, I intend to make a pessimist of you. My dear, are you doing as you should? My dear, black really is your color. When people ask who mentored me, I tell them Arthur Henry King before I mention any others. Pardon the pun, but he was the king of mentors. I had struggled with my writing, finding it exhausting, until I worked with Arthur's words and saw the patterns in my own work, the assonance and consonants, prosody and rhythm. I learned to see my lexis, my syntax and repetition, relaxing my tension and letting my natural resonance and harmonies rise to the surface. Digesting Arthur's writing changed me forever, galvanizing my own ability with literary devices and style, helping my own writing gel. I'd always known I had a bit of talent, but thought my writing pedestrian. In Arthur's poetics, I found some of my own tendencies and came away with a basic better sense of self and voice. I realized I was a writer, and I knew that God or destiny had a plan for me that required both a skill with words and rhetorical integrity. I also knew that God loved radicals as much as conservatives, and thus had taken me from Seventh East Press to Arthur King in one move, where I could fuse the best of both worlds into something finer than either one. Today, Arthur King lives in me every time I write or revise a line. His wisdom breathes in every word I place. We are still a pair, he and I, a couplet of opposites uniting in paradox, transcending conventionality." Do you want to come up here? All right, the question is, would someone on the panel like to talk about his work with Arthur's work with Arthur, with Terry Warner on what was the rest of it? On self-deception.
Terry's the elder brother and one of the earliest of Arthur's honoraries. There's an excellent introduction written by Terry to Arm the Children, which you should know about. I can't respond to your specific question, but Terry does talk about what can I say, their antagonism. and he talks about the intensity of their conversations. Many of us simply sat at the feet of a great mentor and absorbed everything he said. Terry had the capacity, I think that's the right word, the capacity to be argumentative with him. And he also talks in the book about both of them going away having received further light and knowledge, both of them being having their sensibilities enhanced by their conversation. That's all I can add to that.
Are there any other questions? Comments, this is your last chance. All right, then let's close the session. If you have individual questions of the panelists, I'm sure they'd be happy to entertain them. And thank you for coming to celebrate the life of someone that I think we all love very much.